for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. After more than 500 days of negotiations, federal and state officials are on the verge of a landmark settlement with banks on foreclosure fraud. The proposed agreement would provide cash payments to homeowners who lost their homes and relief for those who owe more on their homes than they're worth. Joining me to talk about the pending settlement and other recent housing proposals, Kathleen Day, the Center for Responsible Lending, and Brady Dennis of the Washington Post. Joining us by phone from Sarasota, Florida, Ed Pinto of the American Enterprise Institute. You are welcome to be part of the program, as always. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a Facebook posting or a tweet. And good morning to all of you.
Morning.
Hey, good morning.
Good to have you here. Brady Dennis, remind us how we got here. What's the root of the pending settlement and the agreement of states going forward?
I think it's probably helpful to go back a few years when the housing boom all of a sudden turned into a bust. And these banks that had become really proficient and quick at churning out home loans all of a sudden had to do foreclosures on a similar scale. And quite frankly, they weren't set up for that. And they weren't equipped to do that system-wise, staffing-wise. And what ended up happening, quite frankly, was they began to cut corners in the paperwork that would go into the legal filings for foreclosures. And the range of activities, you know, you had some workers who were signing off on up to 10,000 foreclosure filings a month. You had people signing other people's names, forging other people's names. You had false notarizations. You had backdated mortgage assignments. Just a range of activities, and that became public. That became apparent in the fall of 2010, and as you might imagine, caused quite an outrage in the country. A lot of lenders halted their foreclosures across the country. There were calls for investigations, and that's when the settlement talks began with some of the five biggest banks.
So give me some of the outlines of this planned agreement.
Right. Well, so as you mentioned in the intro, it's been a long time coming, as you might imagine, with 50 state attorneys general involved, federal officials from the Department of Justice and the Housing and Urban Development. The general outlines, we haven't seen a final settlement yet, but the general outlines would include up to $25 billion to help with a range of aid to homeowners. Some would be reducing the loan balances for people who are behind on their mortgages. Some would help to refinance those mortgages into lower interest rates. Also, there's some money put aside for restitution to people who had already lost their homes to foreclosure for damages that they might have suffered during the process. And also one significant big significant piece of the deal is also to end that so-called robo-signing activities, to force some of the lenders and mortgage servicers to pursue more loan modifications to keep people in their homes and to help those homeowners through that process.
Tell me why some states are holding back.
A few states are holding back for various reasons. One in key state is California that hasn't signed on to the deal just yet. Kamala Harris, the AG out there, has said she's not sure it's a sufficient deal given the scope of the foreclosure crisis in her state. Across the country, in places like New York and Delaware, the attorneys general there have expressed concern that any legal releases that the settlement includes might preclude them from doing further investigations into other parts of the mortgage crisis, like the way that loans were packaged and sold in securities. So I think before they were to sign on, they want to make sure that they can pursue those investigations. And so, you know, the organizers said last night they had more than 40 states, but we're still waiting for a few key ones to say which way they're going to go.
Brady Dennis, he's National Economics Reporter for the Washington Post. Kathleen Day, what do you think the proposed settlement? Does it go far enough?
It is not perfect, but it is a huge step forward, and we think strikes a reasonable balance between getting some relief immediately to homeowners that are out there and also preserving the ability of prosecutors, federal and state, to pursue claims of criminal and securities fraud violations.
But I gather it's only about robo-signing fraud and not really focused on fixing bank fraud.
Well, they go together in some cases. But one of the problems with this investigation has been the public expectation that it would solve it. It came to become this emblem that it would solve everything that's gone wrong with the mortgage market. And in fact, it is a defined set of issues surrounding servicing. And so it does end the egregious robo-signing and many other bad practices. And an important one that it ends is or curbs or severely limits is dual tracking, where a homeowner in good faith was negotiating for a loan modification or refinancing only to suddenly be slapped with a foreclosure. So it stops things like that. It says it just common sense things like a homeowner who's negotiating in good faith for a loan modification should be able to deal with the same person each time they call so that they don't have to reinvent the wheel each time. They need to set up an electronic system so documentation that you send in doesn't repeatedly get lost or misplaced. Things like that that are just shouldn't have happened.
AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka said that a sum larger than the rumored $25 billion to fix these problems is not enough. What do you think?
Well, look, the size and scope of this problem is there's almost not enough money. No one has enough money to really fix what happened. This was a big, big train wreck, okay? And just to beat a dead horse and use this analogy, this isn't exactly like just passing out blankets and coffee after the train wreck. It's more like giving people a place to go. But does it really restore everything to where it was beforehand? No, but it was never intended to. That was beyond the scope of what they were looking at.
Kathleen Day, the Center for Responsible Lending. Turning to you, Ed Pinto, what do you think about the proposed settlement?
Well, I have two problems with the proposed settlement. One is, I think when this problem arose about 16 months ago, the administration and the FHFA, the regulator for Fannie and Freddie, both came out and said, first, if there are any practices that are inappropriate, they should be stopped. Two, if there are any homeowners that were harmed by the practices, they lost their home when they shouldn't have, they should be compensated. And three, we need to move on with the foreclosures and not hold up the foreclosure process. Well, 16 months later, we now have the foreclosure process has been stopped up for a very long time. Many, many people have been staying in their homes without paying any monthly payments. The average loan in foreclosure in judicial foreclosure states is now over 2 years without making any payments. So what has been found through this investigation is I have not seen any evidence of actually individual people that were harmed. Yes, there were 10,000 were done in a month or whatever, but were people foreclosed on in mass numbers that shouldn't have been foreclosed on? I have not seen any evidence of that, yet this settlement does two things. It pays billions of dollars to people who were foreclosed upon, and it gives each one $2,000 when they've already in many cases, received other benefits through not having to pay while their foreclosures were held up, which many have been. Secondly, it provides money for principal reduction in many cases. But again, it's not tied to the specifics of the robo-signing. It's tied to other things. And when you get to the other things, that's my second problem, which is government housing policy caused this train wreck. And for the state's attorney general and the government to then come after the fact and try to pin the blame on everybody else rather than the government policies that caused the train wreck, I think is bad policy and is setting a tremendously bad precedent.
Ed Pinto, tell me how you believe that the government housing policy caused this problem.
I just this morning sent out an email that linked to the National People's Action, which is a group active in these matters. Back in 1991, testified before the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. And this is very instructive. It's a very short sentence. Lenders will respond to the most conservative standards unless Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are aggressive and convincing in their efforts to expand historically narrow underwriting. That really lit the fuse that in 1992, when the so-called Safety and Soundness Act was passed, 1995, when the National Home Ownership Strategy was promulgated by then-President Clinton, 1994, when Fannie Mae announced the $1 trillion program, and many other programs that followed in the years that followed. So now we flash forward to 2012, and we have the same group, National People's Action, saying anything less than $300 billion of a settlement would be a travesty. And so after calling for banks to abandon their conservative standards, they now want restitution for the damages that resulted from the banks doing what National People's Action asked for.
Ed Pinto, he's resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, former executive vice president and chief credit officer for Fannie Mae. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, I know we'll have more discussion. Stay with us. And welcome back. As we talk about negotiations among federal and state officials for a landmark settlement with banks on foreclosure fraud, here in the studio, Brady Dennis of the Washington Post, Kathleen Day of the Center for Responsible Lending. On the line with us is Ed Pinto, who's currently with the American Enterprise Institute. He's former executive vice president and chief credit officer for Fannie Mae. His last comment was to the effect that, in fact, government housing policy had caused this huge problem in the housing and mortgage market. Kathleen Day, what's your response to that?
Any bad government policy that contributed to this was lobbied for mightily by the financial services industry. So to say that they lobbied for policies that then they were forced to comply with is ridiculous. And the GSEs, I know this is not a show about the GSEs, Freddie and Fannie, but this is a industry perpetuated myth and narrative that the GSEs caused this problem. There's lots that they did wrong, and they did contribute to it, but they did not cause it. They were followers. This was Wall Street run amok after lobbying not to have any common sense rules in place.
Brady Dennis, does the proposed settlement include loans by Fannie and Freddie?
No, this would mainly deal with loans from the five servicers who are five of the biggest banks in the country. It's Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Ally Financial, which was formerly GMEC. So, you know, the scope of this, at least at the moment, is limited. It would be many, many loans, but it's limited to those lenders. And now the people who the officials negotiating the settlement have said that they hope to get this squared away and create sort of a standard that the industry would adopt, and that they could then use that blueprint to go to other lenders and replicate these standards. So, but at the moment, it's a limited group.
Do you think Fannie and Freddie should have been included in this negotiation, Kathleen?
Well, it might not have been the place to include them, but it is true, as was just mentioned, that the hope is that a standard of servicing will be set so that the GSEs, will Freddie and Fannie, will feel compelled to follow those. But it is also true that Freddie and Fannie need to do more to modify loans under the government's affordable housing modification program. So GSEs could do more, and they should do more, but not necessarily under hopefully they'll use the standards that are established in the AG settlement.
Ed Pinto, I want to go back to your comment about government really being at fault here. What about the idea that Freddie was betting against homeowners who were taking out mortgages, and to Kathleen's point, that the lobbyists were really pushing for these mortgage rates?
Well, on your first point, Diane, I would I have a little different view than some. I think one of the original sins for Fannie and Freddie was the portfolio. They had two businesses. They were guaranteeing loans, and they were owning mortgage investments, which they called their portfolio. And it was the portfolio that was incredibly profitable, because it was basically following the usual borrow short, lend long, and earn a big spread on the difference. And that's what caused problems on a couple of occasions for Fannie and Freddie. And so we now have a situation where in 2008, when they were put in the conservatorship, the clear goal, as evidenced by the agreement that was entered into, was to reduce these massive portfolios and eventually get them down to a much more manageable size. So what we now have is Fannie and Freddie still have fairly large portfolios. They've gone down some, but unfortunately in 2009, they were granted the ability to keep the portfolios larger than they otherwise had been. Just in 2008. And so Freddie was still doing things to hedge this portfolio in ways that I think were probably inappropriate, just because they were the ultimate in what's known as moral hazard, or heads I win, tails you lose. Because if the bet turned out to be a good one, then Freddie would earn a lot of money. And if the bet turned out to be a bad one, the taxpayer would be on the hook. So it was just a continuation of the same crony capitalism, socialize the losses when there are some. If you have some profits, it'll make Freddie look better and might lead to a better result from Freddie's perspective down the road. So, I mean, that's the way I look at it. I don't know that it was a bet on homeowners or anything. I think that gets a bit tenuous. But I just think it was inappropriate for them to be involved in this, using what is, in effect, taxpayers' money to run a hedge fund.
Kathleen Day.
Well, first of all, I don't know enough, and I don't know if Mr. Pinto knows enough to know all the details of what Freddie Mac did. But it's also true that every company that has a product, whether you're Nestle's with cocoa or you're the Freddie and Fannie with mortgages, you also buy an insurance contract, which is called a derivative, which basically insures. It's a responsible thing to do. So that if your product somehow the pricing of it doesn't turn the way you expected it to go, you will then have this insurance product which will make up for some of the loss. You could argue, and again, I don't know the details of Freddie Mac, so I'm not defending them or commenting on them per se, but just because they hedged using derivatives, that's what every major corporation does. And in fact, if major corporations didn't, people would say, oh my gosh, you're irresponsible for not doing it. You have a responsibility to minimize taxpayer loss.
All right.
May I add something?
Sure. Go right ahead.
What's not generally known is, as I said, Freddie and Fannie, their main business is guaranteeing mortgages. That's known. They collect servicing guarantee fees or a piece of the interest rate. and it's known as an interest-only strip. It's just comprised of interest. And so they already have a big hedge against their portfolio because their main business, which between them totals $5 trillion in guarantee fees, on $5 trillion of loans, is an interest-only strip. You would normally hedge that with a portfolio asset. So here you have Freddie having a hedge already natural from their business, hedging a portfolio, and then going out and taking out additional very risky, volatile assets to further potentially make money or not make money. Again, I really think it was looking like a hedge fund, but that's not commonly known that they already had a very ample hedge in this particular risk.
All right. I want to move on here. We have an email from Jim in Indiana who says, I believe it would be a mistake to accept any settlement that would absolve the banks of any criminal wrongdoing. Accepting this agreement now would effectively stop the investigation before we even know exactly what went on. I'd like to hear your guests explore this aspect in detail. Brady.
Well, first of all, it's probably important to point out that these are civil actions that are being invested or being settled right now. So criminal would be something separate entirely. But it's entirely appropriate to debate whether how broad an immunity the bank should be granted in return for these penalties that they're going to pay and the changes that they're going to make. And that's the debate that you're seeing take place among the attorneys general right now as they try to finalize this deal. There are some who worry that the legal releases, and we haven't seen the exact language on this, worry that they'll go too far and amount to a slap on the wrist and let the banks off the hook. The people who are negotiating the deal have said we've done our best to craft a very narrow legal release so that it deals with the issues at hand and that it allows other investigations to go forward. So I guess we'll just see where that ends up, but it's still very much a sticking point.
All right. And here's another email from Sherry in Howell, Michigan, who says, I'd like to point out that many people struggling to pay their mortgages are like me, people like me who've been unemployed for a long time, whose mortgages were taken out many years ago with substantial down payments and good credit at the time. I know many in this situation and others whose homes are now worth far less than is owed on their mortgages, none of whom are irresponsible borrowers. We are not part of the problem and are paying dearly for it. Kathleen.
There's no question about it. One of the things that should have happened, I was calculating it on my way in, 4.5 years ago, we've been talking about how to short-circuit the foreclosure crisis. And in fact, this person makes a good point. Their property value, every time there's a foreclosure, then surrounding property values go down in value. I really take exception to Mr. Pinto's assertion that no one was harmed. Tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people have been put into foreclosure without proper due process. And very likely many of them could, hundreds of thousands, could have and should have been put into a loan modification, which would have been better for everyone. It would have prevented the foreclosure that depresses surrounding property values. It would have stopped eroding local tax bases. And it just would have been better for everyone. And so now everyone, almost everyone, has come to that conclusion. But it was the banks, let's not forget, it was the banks 4.5 years ago that absolutely lobbied against every effort to compel them to do loan modifications. And they said, we'll do it voluntarily. We'll set up the systems. We will do it. And look, now they didn't do it, and it's cost us all, including this homeowner.
What about that, Ed Pinto?
Well, there's a lot of facets to that question. I would focus on one. The individuals who have been paying for 5 years and are underwater, I do think there is an approach that makes sense for those borrowers, which would be to, and I think it starts with Fannie and Freddie, and I've suggested this, it hasn't been done. You take all the borrowers that Fannie and Freddie have that have been current, what the president calls responsible borrowers. Let's assume that there's a definition of that, responsible borrower. And anybody who's more than 20% underwater has their loan automatically modified by Fannie or Freddie from the current, it averages about 6.1% to today's rate, about 3.25%, 3.5%. But instead of the mortgage payment going down, the loan term shortens. Because the one thing that we haven't done in all of this, and we can talk about all of the individual, you know, cases and the anecdotal instances, but we've had house prices drop by something on the order of 25 to 30% nationally, yet in terms of the outstanding mortgage balances, from the peak in 2007, first mortgages have dropped by about 5%. We've done very little to reduce the leverage, and that's what's really dragging on the market. And it's because we haven't had the foreclosures that should take place occur expeditiously. We haven't had, instead of allowing refinances where loan terms are extended and it's used as a false stimulus program to put some more money in people's pocket, yet the money came out of somebody else's pocket because it's a zero-sum game. Instead, we should be lowering the amortization term and paying off these loans. If they were did what I the example I just gave, instead of having 25 years left, a loan would amortize in about 16 or 17 years. And at the end of 5 years, they wouldn't be underwater anymore. Positive progress towards solving the problem. We haven't really addressed the problem, which is over leverage and too few jobs.
Ed Pinto of the American Enterprise Institute, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Do you want to comment, Brady?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think Ed makes a good point that there is a limbo in the markets right now because when these slightly different point, when these when this robo-signing activity became public, the lenders did sort of freeze foreclosures for a while, and that has left a lot of properties and probably a lot of very legitimate
in limbo.
And I think a lot of people agree that that is delaying, you know, a rebound in the housing market to the extent that there would have been a rebound. On the refinancing point, I think this has been one of the great dilemmas of the housing crisis is that we have historically low interest rates, and so many people, like the woman who emailed in, can't take advantage of those, either because their house is worth a lot less than they paid for it or because they simply no longer have the credit to qualify for a refinancing. And, you know, you're seeing the administration, I think, try to push more to make that happen, but it's really not happened yet for millions of people who could benefit from that refinancing.
All right. I want to open the phones here and go first to Arlie in Putney, Vermont. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
You're most welcome.
I had just a couple of things I wanted to bring up, and one just in response to a couple of comments just recently. The robo-signing issue, let's call it what it is. They were fraudulently submitting documents to the courts. This is fraud. It's not just, you know, it's don't just sweep this under the rug. But more importantly, at least from my perspective, is in 1997, when the banks kind of from whole cloth created the mortgage electronic registration system, the MERS system, in order to sidestep paying the local registrar's offices the fees every time they moved a document from one owner to another, as they were creating these large securities out of all of these different mortgages, they broke the chain of title for those properties. So now you have an entire group of properties and nobody knows who owns it, because the chain of title has been broken. MERS is not a person. It's not an entity. They didn't file the registrations with the appropriate county land assessor's offices. So when a property is foreclosed on, if I bought a foreclosed property now, there's no guarantee to me that that title is clean and that I actually would own that property.
Kathleen.
That's quite true. It has made a mess of being able to establish who owns the mortgage, not the house. The homeowner presumes. But so it's absolutely true that MERS is, it's known as MERS, and it's based in Northern Virginia, and it's a mess. And it was a mess, and that is one of the problems that the industry in setting up and automating the loan making process, they made it so they did everything so quickly that they cut corners. And so again, when it was time to fix or people started defaulting, the only thing the banks knew is foreclosure. They weren't set up to do mass loan modifications and evaluate it properly. So the gentleman is quite right. One thing I would like to say about Mr. Pinta, though, I think he suggested that we should raise current homeowners' monthly payments, because if you
No, I did not say that. I said we should keep the payments the same and lower the amortization point. So
you're for principal reduction.
Keep the payment the same. The loan will pay off much faster.
So you're for principal reduction.
Leverage problem.
Are you for principal reduction, Ed?
I'm not for principal reduction.
Okay. That's all I wanted to hear. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and health care. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
Demand for chocolate is going up, but climate change, plant disease, and farming practices threaten production worldwide. For this month's Environmental Outlook, Saving Chocolate, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we'll go right back to the phones. Let's go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Derek. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. What a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you.
I would just like to say that I am one of the victims that was put into foreclosure without the proper paperwork. In fact, I lost my job in 2008, at which time I stayed current with my mortgage, my insurance, tried loan remodification, short sale, to the point where Bank of America would not participate in waiving the deficiency because they weren't participating in that program for Freddie Mac. And I think that if it is true that this settlement will give us about $1,800 per household, it's just not acceptable for all the trouble that I've gone through trying to work with the system, trying to do what was right, only 2-3 years later to be told, we'll write, give you a check for $1,800, and that'll be it, really, I don't think is fair. I'm sorry.
Brady.
The caller makes a good point. I mean, there's been example after example of homeowner I've talked to who has just gone through a maddening maze of bureaucracy in trying to deal with these lenders who, in fairness, are also overwhelmed. And so the settlement aims to rectify that. The caller makes the point that it's too late in his case.
And too little.
And then too little. I will point out that apparently the settlement does not preclude people who have gone through similar situations. They can accept that payment and still be eligible to file claims in like a class action lawsuit. So,
did you know that, Derek? Derek, are you still there? Derek? No, I guess he's not.
This is Ed. I think that raises a very good point. The problem with this lawsuit is it isn't dealing with specific instances of individuals, yet it's a massive amount of money, $25 billion. It's one thing to say, you know, these were the practices, and we're going to stop these practices. These are the practices we're going to have in the future. This is some, you know, reasonable amount of restitution is going to be made. But if all of, you know, people like Derek should be allowed to go and have their day in court and get compensated. But to give, I mean, I think where the lenders are having trouble is to pay $25 billion for general stuff and then still be open to all of the other lawsuits. The $25 billion number is the problem. They're trying to come up with a massive settlement that divvies it up among a lot of different states, when, in fact, the individual claims haven't been dealt with. You're going to give people who haven't been harmed $2,000, and yet the people who, you know, arguably have been harmed are, you know, not, they still have to go forward to get their day in court.
Kathleen.
That's just nonsense. First of all, people, they don't automatically get the money. You will have to show that you that something was done to you. Of course, it's not enough to, it's not sufficient recompense to make the person whole. But frankly, the banks made such, and the investment banks made such a mess of this. There's not enough money, really, to compensate people for all that
so
they've
So you would agree with Trump that $25 billion that people are talking about is not going to be enough to fix this.
But it was not intended. It's not intended to. But it's probably it gets money into the pocket of people who are harmed sooner than if they had to have a protracted legal.
All right, to Richmond, Virginia. Good morning, Jack.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
Listen to you daily, and this is my first time calling. I'm going to give you the facts really quickly because I know we're short on time. I'm 43. I've been on disability. We bought our first house in 03. It was a fixer-upper. We had borrowed money from friends and family. My bank locally sold it to IndyMac around 2008 due to my disability, my medical bills, and my wife losing the job. We went into foreclosure. At the time, we sought out help from attorneys, et cetera. There weren't really any options available except to walk away or file bankruptcy. So we walked away. Meanwhile, the house sat empty for 2.5 years. It's now been bought and sold twice with investors making a ton of money. And despite the errors in the paperwork, et cetera, we lost everything. And I'm just very angry. And I know this call probably doesn't address some of my issues, but it's just pathetic, and I can't even find the words to describe it.
I'm sorry you're in that kind of situation, Brady.
Well, I know that Kathleen mentioned, you know, that a lot of people are in that situation, and that everyone arguably would be better off—the banks, the homeowners, the neighborhoods—if there were a way fairly to keep people in their homes, at least people who still have some hope of maintaining their mortgage.
What about renting, Kathleen?
People are experimenting with the idea of renting and taking some of these properties, and those are all good. And you know, all these things are incremental. Add to the solution. There is no one silver bullet. So we should be doing all these things and trying things. But one thing I want to have everyone remember is, why did the AG investigation have to happen in the first place? Federal regulators told the attorneys general in the 50 states to shut up and sit down while all these bad practices were going on. And it was called preemption. But then suddenly the federal bank regulator said, whoops, we let them do all these bad things. And now Dodd-Frank, the financial reform bill, rolls allows the attorneys general a seat at the table going forward to stand shoulder or sit shoulder to shoulder with federal regulators to police for bad practices. But let's remember how we got here in the first place is federal government tied the AG's hands.
All right, to Katie in, Cynthia in Katy, Texas, you're on the air.
Hi, I am recently moved from Florida. My two questions are, we've not heard from Pam Bondi at all. She's had the third or second highest foreclosure rate in the country. We've heard nothing that she's doing to try and help the Florida homeowners. My home was taken last year after a five-year battle with Wells Fargo of, you know, the lost paperwork, the whatever, whatever. I tried to go to court. I tried to hire lawyers. And the bottom line was an illegal foreclosure and an illegal eviction of myself and my two children of my house 10 years. Well, we decided to move to Texas to be near our family, but, you know, the human toll of it is more than the house is worth, and I'm wondering, why haven't we heard from Pam Bondi? And secondly, you know, individually, what can homeowners do, you know, to be compensated to,
yeah.
I don't know if, you know, I can regain any kind of claim to my house since Duval County has put me out, the banks have put me out, and at the same time, nobody knows who really owns the mortgage. So,
Cynthia, you are in a pickle, clearly. And just to clarify, Pam Bondi is the Republican Attorney General from Florida. What can you say, Brady?
I just want to take a second to key in on something that your caller said about the human toll of this.
Of course.
I spent about 7 years in Florida and have been back many times since the crisis. And it doesn't take much to drive through the neighborhoods and see that foreclosures and empty houses, you know, the policy arguments aside, have sort of an exponential toll on the people who are still living there. And there's really few places worse than Florida to go and see that, even today. As far as Pam Bondi is concerned, there was a lot of Florida was a mess, a lot of wrongdoing in that state. You know,
what kind of wrongdoing?
Well, you know, Florida had this interesting thing called the Rocket Docket in its courts, in which the foreclosures would just be churned through. I saw judges signing foreclosures as fast as their hands could go, and, you know, in fairness, most of them probably were legitimate foreclosures, but at that speed, there were a lot of questions of the legality. So Florida, I think by all accounts, Pam Bondi is probably most likely engaged in the current settlement, likely to accept what aid she can get for her state. But like other states, it's not going to solve the problem entirely.
And what can Cynthia do at this point, Kathleen?
Well, she might want to get an attorney and see what possibly could be done. When the settlement is signed, she'll want to go on to the check in with the attorneys general. I'm sure they'll have instructions on what to do. And where to go to try to get some relief.
All right. Ed Pinto, any comment?
I think there are lots of, stories that are heartrending, and you know, we're hearing some here, and there may be redress for those. But we also have to look at how do we get the continuing problem of our economy, you know, of being languishing, moving forward. And having... I went through the process in Texas in the early 80s, which Texas had rapid foreclosure process in place, and it was heart-wrenching to go through, but it turned the economy in Texas around very quickly. Texas came back very quickly, and everyone who unemployed people got jobs, and the economy just turned around. What we're doing here is we keep postponing the solution, and so we're now 3.5-4 years into this problem, and there's no end in sight.
Right.
We should be bottoming out, and if we don't get these foreclosures cleared, we won't. And so I understand there are these cases, but you also have to look at how do we get our economy moving. In the meantime, we keep interest rates near zero. I mean, we're just creating the next set of problems with what we're doing today.
Right.
Well, I think, for better or worse, we're going to have this national discussion because you have Mitt Romney on the campaign trail right now, and other Republicans say, let the market do its job. Let's clear the foreclosures out, as painful as it will be, and let it run its course.
What does that mean, clear the foreclosures out? Toss people out of their houses? Is that what that means?
It means speed up the process. In states like New York or New Jersey, you know, it can take 2-3 years to legally go through a process. And I think there a lot of people argue that that should be a much shorter process.
But who made it such a tangle to go through? The banks, it was their fault that their servicing procedures are a total shambles. And I'm sure Mr. Pinto is not saying, let's just let everyone out of their house, let's kick them out without due process of law. You're not suggesting that, Mr. Pinto, are you? Just kick people
I'm
out?
I'm suggesting that we let the foreclosures go forward based on the facts that we do.
But if you don't have the facts, if your record keeping is a mess, how do you get the facts?
Artificial stay for 16 months on many of the foreclosures in places like foreclosure, like Florida and other states. And so the recovery that is starting in other states, Arizona has about as bad a situation as Florida, yet the current non-performing loan numbers in Arizona are half what they are in Florida. And Arizona is starting to recover. Economically, it's recovering. Florida, by the way, the jobs are growing, but there's still a lot that needs to happen on the housing front. But we're really just slowing down the recovery, and the studies that have been shown. I mean, individuals that lose their homes, and again, I don't want to get into specifics because I'm sure there are cases that are heartrending. But you move from one house as an owner where you don't have any equity to a house where you're renting for a period, and it could be a very similar house. There are studies that show there's a lot of that movement going on in Phoenix, Arizona. That's what's happening.
All right.
The market needs to adjust, and we have been artificially holding that back.
All right. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Taking this back once again to the personal, here's an email from John who says, I'm currently trying to track down the paper on my mortgage, which apparently was mishandled by Bank of America. Will this broad settlement affect my individual right to relief? If so, will I have any sort of opt-out rights? Kathleen?
At one of the essential points in the proposed settlement, as I understand it, of course, it all depends on what happens finally, but is that banks will be obliged to provide documentation to homeowners in full, in a timely manner, and that upon request, they will have to show before they can foreclose that they have the proper paperwork, that they know who owns the mortgage, and things that yes, the answer to this person is yes, you will be entitled to that. You always should have had it, and you could argue you were entitled to it, but this is going to be one of the terms of the settlement enforceable by a judge.
All right. And how will this proposed agreement be enforced, Brady?
Well, as I understand it, built into the deal is a full-time position that the banks will pay for through the settlement for a person to essentially oversee this deal and enforce the terms of it. And we learned that that person is the current North Carolina Banking Commissioner, Joseph Smith, who, as you'll remember, President Obama nominated to head the overseer of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but he never got confirmed, so he went back to North Carolina, and now appears that he'll be overseeing this settlement here.
Do you think that will work, Kathleen?
Yes. The attorneys general have learned from an agreement that Nevada entered into some years back with Nevada, where some of the ways to hold the countrywide and Bank of America's feet to the fire weren't ironclad enough. So they've learned from that, and they've tightened it up in this settlement. They definitely have.
And Ed Pinto, what do you think of the enforcement? Ed Pinto?
What the agreement says, I think the enforcement will probably go, fairly well, but again, one of the problem we run into is all of these programs. Let me just give you an example. 2 weeks ago,
very quickly, please.
I will. 2 weeks ago, the president announced a new program. It wasn't ready for to be dealt with because the details were unavailable. But I'm sure millions of phone calls were placed to servicers. A week later, he announced more details, but still not ready to implement. Yet again, millions of phone calls get placed. We've done this time after time, and it really clogs up the process for the servicers, which are overwhelmed with all of the phone calls.
The system is less than perfect. No one's going to say it's worked smoothly. But let's not forget, Obama inherited this problem. I mean, he inherited the biggest bailout, the biggest financial meltdown this country has seen since the Great Depression. I mean, it's imperfect, but it's improving.
And clearly, this discussion is going to continue with the millions of homeowners who are affected. I hope we can find some solution. Kathleen Day, Brady Dennis, and Ed Pinto, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Car